In part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
It's 6 minutes after 1 o'clock, and Celeste is not here today. A little bit under the weather. My name's Jason Croft, filling in. So today we reach into the Afternoon Magazine archives for an interview that Celeste Quinn conducted with journalist Jonathan Randall, author of Osama, The Making of a Terrorist. This was recorded November 10th of last year. And since it is an archive, no phone calls, please.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Journalist Jonathan Randall, author of Osama, The Making of a Terrorist, is our guest this afternoon. Randall, a former foreign correspondent for The Washington Post, traces the birth and growth of bin Laden's jihad against America in this book, which a reviewer for The New York Times describes as a biography of a hatred. Because of the attacks of September 11th, Osama bin Laden is seen in the U.S. as the world's most wanted man, but he was a terrorist long before 9/11. While bin Laden is infamous in the West, he remains very much in the shadows. In Jonathan Randall's book, Osama, The Making of a Terrorist, an outline of him emerges, and we see the rise of his jihad around the world. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest, Jonathan Randall. His career as a journalist began in 1957. He broke into the field at United Press in Paris. He also worked for Time, the Paris Herald, and the New York Times before joining the Washington Post, where he stayed for nearly 30 years. He covered stories from Southeast Asia to Africa and the Middle East. Osama, The Making of a Terrorist, is his third book. His previous books are Going All the Way, Christian Warlords, Israeli Adventurers, and the War in Lebanon, and After Such Knowledge, What Forgiveness? My Encounters with Kurdistan. His new book, Osama, is published by Knopf. Mr. Randall, good afternoon. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
A new video of Osama bin Laden surfaced late in October, late last month. What are your thoughts about him in this video, his message and how he looks?
Well, the most important thing is he's alive and well, and there was some question about both of those aspects of his mystery. He has a very highly developed self-advertising aspect to his life, and the timing was not fortuitous. He'd been more than a year since he'd actually appeared on video, and he wasn't looking too fit then. There'd been a couple of radio audio tapes that the CIA authenticated, but people weren't entirely sure if it was the real McCoy. So by showing up on everybody of the world's television screens 4 days before the American election, he was certainly making a statement. The real question is, what kind of a statement did he want to make?
Right.
I think he, in my humble view, he wanted to influence the American election, and I have a theory that he favored Bush over Kerry because Kerry is a wonderful Kerry would have been a new face, whereas Bush was a wonderful recruiting sergeant for his cause. I think also that the cassette was designed to tell those people who believe in him that he was alive and well and could pick a time of his own to make a very dramatic reappearance.
Yeah. At least one observer, an expert on terrorism for the RAND Corporation, Bruce Hoffman, has said bin Laden in this tape is trying to portray himself as a statesman.
Well, statesman, yes. I mean, there's one little gimmick there that was very interesting to me. I've spent 5 years of my life worrying about him. And that is, for the first time I can remember, on a video, he appeared without his trademark Soviet assault rifle. He was, every time in the past he's had this weapon by his side. It was a statement that he was a warrior as well as anything else. And the fact that he neglected to have that weapon along, I think, did mean that he was appealing, especially to Americans, to show that he was something else than just a terrorist. Statesman, I think, perhaps is pushing things a bit too far, but I have great respect for Mr. Hoffman, and I will leave the authorship of that coinage to him.
Yeah. You know, one wonders with Yasser Arafat apparently near death, one wonders if bin Laden could see an opportunity to build on his reputation as an Islamist hero, you know, able to challenge the U.S. and its allies.
Well, I think, with all due respect, I think it's a little... Palestine is a very complicated and problem all of its own. I don't think that Osama's would be well advised, from his point of view, to put his oar into the Palestinian affair. That said, he's used the Palestinian issue time and again because it is the one issue that unifies Muslims at well beyond the tiny fringe of fanatics who were attracted to Al-Qaeda and inspired by bin Laden. In other words, he's sort of riding the shirt tails of feeling, deeply held feeling in the Muslim world and beyond it. Let's face it, in much of the Western Europe and the rest of the world, that the Palestinians haven't gotten a fair shake and that they're in bad shape.
And if there was a viable Palestinian state alongside Israel, would that help to defuse the current situation in terms of Osama bin Laden and world terror?
Well, I don't. You know, I'm an old man. I tend to be somewhat pessimistic about what it might be meant by viable a Palestinian state alongside Israel. But certainly, some kind of negotiated political settlement of the Palestinian issue would do a great deal to defang jihadi terrorism, just as settlement of the Kashmir problem between Pakistan and India would. I mean, these are festering problems that have been going on for decades and decades and decades and decades, and if you can be seen to finding a solution to these issues, that means the Islamist terrorists have to look much further afield to find issues that have the same appeal.
Mm. You point out in this book, Osama, The Making of a Terrorist, that he is a person who is intent on building a myth, a legend about himself, and he's been working on this image for years. What is his vision of himself, and how has your thinking about him changed over time?
Well, I think he feels that his place in Islamic and indeed world history has been secured by 9/11. When you think that the relative pittance he's spent over the years to make himself a world figure. I mean, you could go to any village in the world, and people, all you have to say is Osama. You don't even have to say bin Laden, and the most primitive people, the most uninformed people know who he is. His brand name outshines that of Coca-Cola or General Motors or whatever you will. I mean, he's gotten a lot of mileage in terms of self-advertising. What he wants to be himself, I think, is the person who sets up the caliphate. Now, the caliphate is the temporal side of Islamic rule, and the last time anybody exercised the caliphate was in the Ottoman Empire, and indeed, modern Turkey, when it became a republic in 1924, did away with the caliphate. And time, the idea comes back in the statements of Osama and other Islamists, the Ummah, the people of Islam, must be ruled by the caliphate. So that's one aspect of things. The other thing is, he feels that any country that once was Islamic, once was Muslim, should be again. So let's take Spain. The Christian monarchy of Spain in 1492, at the end of the 15th century, kicked out the last Muslim rulers after a rule of eight centuries. So we don't think of Spain as a Muslim country, but Osama does. Similarly, the republics of Central Asia that were under Russian and then under Soviet control for the better part of it, for more than a century, he also sees as legitimate targets. And beyond that, he is opposed to what he considers to be the corrupt and colonized leaders of Muslim countries that are friendly, or in his eyes, too friendly to the West. So that would include almost every Muslim country of importance, and certainly all those countries that have been America's allies for decades.
Hmm. Why this particular individual? He was an average young man. He was one of 54 children. How did he manage to rise to the place he is today, where he is, his name Osama is better known than Coca-Cola,
well,
General Motors?
Well, I think, in a way, with all due respect, it's somewhat of a contradiction of terms. I mean, if you have 53 siblings, that isn't just, you're not John Q. Citizen, especially if your father was extremely hardworking, brilliant, but illiterate immigrant to Saudi Arabia, and your mother was another immigrant. She came from Syria. His father came from next door in Yemen, arrived penniless at the age of 18, and built one of the great construction firm empires of the world. His mother was a very beautiful woman from Syria, and not only is she from Syria, she belongs to a sect that mainstream Muslims, be they Sunni or Shia, don't even consider to be part of Islam. So that he comes, you know, that's quite a lot of baggage for a young man like Osama. Osama was only 10 when his father died. Unlike most of his brothers and many of his sisters, half-sisters, he did not travel abroad. He was not educated in the United States or in Western Europe. He stayed at home. He always had a reputation as being quite pious. I've talked to people who knew him as a teenager. But on the other hand, he got on very well with Westerners. I mean, the family construction firm used him, and there many of the engineers were Western Europeans or Americans. He spoke good English. He had absolutely no problems with them. And I've talked to the man who was his immediate boss who told me that. So the question is, what happened? Well, I think what happened is that when the Soviet army invaded Afghanistan on Christmas 1978, basically the United States and Saudi Arabia, meaning the royal family, came to an understanding that they would match dollar for dollar the other's contributions. And above and beyond that, in other words, the Saudis and the American government basically paid for that war. And above and beyond that, there was an enormous amount of money raised by what I would call mosque money, people, pious Muslims who were investing in the sacred cause of getting a godless communist, quote-unquote, regime, the Soviets, out of Afghanistan. And the way that worked was, in every governorate of Saudi Arabia, let's call it every state, there was a prince of the realm who was the governor, and he also was the head of the committee to raise funds, and he would appoint members of prominent families as his assistants, with the idea being that if the best and the brightest and the richest showed the way, more humble Muslims would also contribute. Indeed, the first time that Osama went to Pakistan in the early 1980s, he went as a fundraiser. And even when he was fighting in the field, many months of every year he spent in Saudi Arabia, raising money. Another enormously important contribution to the making of the myth is the Saudi press. The Saudi Arabians did not have a great deal, a great pool of people to make heroes out of. The founding father of the kingdom, King Ibn Saud, had been dead since 1953, so the Saudis were hungering after a hero, and Osama was that. He was everybody's ideal in Saudi Arabia. He was a well-spoken, handsome, son of a merchant prince who had given up everything for the cause. So that was made him very, very attractive. And there's another extremely important thing that happened was when the United States, Saudi Arabia, and everybody else under the sun, an alliance that went from the Chinese to the Israelis, when all these countries and governments decided to bleed the Soviets in Afghanistan, young Muslims were encouraged to go to Pakistan and Afghanistan in a way to show the flag, to show their distaste for what the Soviets were doing. So young men from the Atlantic coast and Morocco and Mauritania all the way down to Indonesia and the South Seas and the southern Philippines, right through the Muslim heartland, were encouraged to go and basically bear witness against what the Soviets were doing. And it was sort of I term it sort of a giant Boy Scout jamboree of a very Muslim sort. And there was a great deal of exchange of thoughts, exchange of feelings. And in that process, I think Osama, who had been fairly naive and sheltered, came into focus. I mean, he was influenced by people who were much more politically minded and much more much better versed in Islamist politics than he was. So it is wrong to say that the United States made Osama, as some people have said. That's quite wrong. But it is true that his presence in Pakistan and in Afghanistan and rubbing up against Muslims from all over the world did inspire him with one very important idea. And that important idea was, if we Muslims have been able to beat the Soviet Union, we can beat the United States. Now, he narrowed it down. Basically, he really was thinking about Arabs. And in fact, the Arabs' main contribution, as I pointed out earlier, was money. I've talked to a very good Syrian journalist who was there throughout, and he's written a book in which he says only 44 Arab volunteers were killed during the entire 1980s when the Soviet army was in Afghanistan. But what the key idea for Osama was to form a kind of Islamic foreign legion, and that it would be a standing force, and if something had to be done about, let's say, Central Asia, those Islamic Muslims in Central Asia, the former Soviet Union, but still the Soviet Union at the time, then this union, this Islamic Legion would lead the way.
Hmm. You mentioned money. Where is the money coming from now, and how successful or unsuccessful has the efforts of the U.S. been to block his source of money?
Well, you know, I've spent 40 years on and off in the Muslim world, and it's a cash and carry region. I mean, I'm still wearing today the money belt that I had back in the late 50s, and it's, you know, it's nothing, absolutely nothing for Muslims, and especially for Arabs, to walk around with $500,000, $10,000 is absolutely nothing in cash. I mean, you know. Yes, there are ATM machines in some countries of the Muslim world, but it's still a part of the world where cash is king. So that's one of our problems. The second thing is that a lot of very, as Osama has said repeatedly, that he's got some very bright guys who know all about banking, finance, moving money, the Internet, and frankly, I don't think we're very much along the path to stopping those funds from reaching him. The second thing is, he doesn't need that much money.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you one figure. The American government has estimated that Osama may have spent as much as $500,000, $500,000 on 9/11. And the Americans said, what, $500,000? That's nothing. That's chicken feed. Well, for Osama is very close to his pennies, and for him, he'd never spent more than $50,000 on any other operation. He's a cheapskate. So for him to spend 10 times as much money as he did on a normal operation, a normal quote-unquote operation, that was a big deal.
Hmm.
He doesn't need that much money.
Yeah. And also, his organization is, you know, loosely organized.
Terribly loosely organized, and it's a lot of it's by emulation. You know, people at 9/11, attracted a lot of footloose young Muslims. Thank the Lord, not that many, but enough to be able to carry out terrorist attacks all over the world. We haven't been attacked here in America since 9/11, but if you look at the map of where terrorist attacks have taken place since then, you know, it ranges from Morocco to Kenya to Indonesia, to
Spain.
Turkey, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, last March in Spain.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very cheap and very clever operation. To what degree were the perpetrators, or mostly Moroccan immigrants to Spain, in touch with Osama? To what degree were they financed by Osama? To what degree were the masterminds formed by Osama? All these are questions. Some of the answers are still quite gray, but it was diabolically clever. Instead of having a suicide attack, the perpetrators left backpacks full of explosives and a timer, and they set them off with cell phones. Luckily for Spain, they were off by a couple of minutes. Had all those four trains been in Atocha station, a train station in Madrid, where the trains were pulling in, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds more people would have been killed. I mean, the glass roof of the train station would have collapsed, and God knows how many victims there would have been.
Yeah. Longtime foreign correspondent Jonathan Randall is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of Osama, The Making of a Terrorist. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with questions and comments. 333-9455, the number to call, the number to use in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, you can call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. In this book, one of the observations you make, one of the things that you report to us, is there is no one-size-fits-all kind of terrorism. And you mention a French anti-terrorism judge who likened terrorism to the AIDS virus, capable of endless mutations. Is that also what the 9/11 Commission alluded to when it said our counterterrorism efforts have lacked imagination?
Well, I think yes. I mean, it's a lot. We have a lot of imagination, but I think in the defense of the administration, both Clinton and the Bush one, George W. Bush's first term. In all fairness, I think we've got to think what kind of a country we were when the Cold War ended, when the Berlin Wall came down in the fall of 1989. You know, for the better part of a half century, all our intelligence effort had been made against the Soviet Union and its allies. It's very difficult, I think, to change gears, especially in intelligence operations. You know, everything had been geared on Moscow, and I think we were certainly aware of Osama, less so than some of the European countries, but I just don't think you turn an enormous ocean liner of a intelligence community around that quickly. So, yes, we didn't know very much, and we weren't very imaginative. We weren't imaginative also because over the last, you know, since Stansfield Turner was Carter's CIA director, we've been sort of getting rid of agents, field agents. We relied enormously on our extremely sophisticated technical means. We've got satellites that can capture and listen to telephone conversations throughout the world. We have other satellites that take pictures of every square foot. You know, we're a technologically advanced nation, and I think in a way we forgot the virtues of what I would call shoe leather reporting, or at least that's how I'd call it if spies were journalists.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we didn't have Arabic speakers, or if we had Arabic speakers, we didn't have enough of them. And if we did have them, even in sufficient qualities, they were not the kind of guys who would go out and spend long months and months and years infiltrating Islamist terrorist organizations. I mean, no women, no booze, no rock and roll. I mean, I'm happy to learn that the State Department, and I'm sure the CIA as well, is now giving priority to recruiting young Americans who either are of Arab-American background or have studied Arabic or Persian or Urdu, and so the languages which we are so essential in this fight against terrorism. We're giving those people priority when we take in new government employees. But that is a total reversal of a trend that had gone on for 25 years.
Yeah. Well, that trend, it seems to me, also made us vulnerable to erroneous and, in the chapter on Sudan, spurious intelligence, you mention.
Well, the Sudan's a bit special. We basically all but closed down the embassy. The embassy stayed open, but we didn't staff it for a long time. And when you're not there, you can't, you know, when you're not on the scene, you don't exercise much influence. And basically, through much of the 90s, we considered the Sudanese regime, which is an Islamist regime, to be evil, and we were instrumental in placing sanctions, economic sanctions on that regime. But we weren't there wheeling and dealing and trying to influence them. So that Osama was there. We did want to get rid of Osama. We did get him out of the Sudan. But remember also that before the September 11th, this is a country governed by, and terribly proud to be governed, by the rule of law. There was no Guantanamos. There were no shortcuts with witnesses. When push came to shove, we didn't know that much about Osama before he left in May 96, before he left the Sudan to go to Afghanistan. And what we did know was not considered sufficient to bring him by force to the United States and put him on trial. A case would have been thrown out. Now, we suffered from a lot of bad luck because just at the time we were getting rid of Osama because we guessed he was up to no good. We didn't really know the facts. One of his former employees who had stolen $110,000 from Osama and thus was on the lam, this fellow knocked on a lot of doors in a lot of embassies of a lot of countries. He finally ended up knocking on the door of the American embassy in Eritrea, the country next door to Sudan. And his line was, "You want to know about Osama Laden? About Osama bin Laden? I'm your man. I'm a sworn member of Al Qaeda. I've done bayat, as it's called." And it took a while to establish this guy's bona fides, but he turned out to be a gold mine. He was the first person, I believe, I'm not privy to government documents that have not been released, but as far as I was able to ascertain, this man was named Fadl, was the first person who gave the United States government a real view of what Osama was up to, and it was pretty frightening. But by that time, Osama was back in Afghanistan, and he was back there because we drove him out of the Sudan. And this amused the Sudanese, who kept telling us, "If you're worried about Osama, we'll keep an eye on him for you." We weren't listening to that. We wanted him out because we were worried about that he would cause more trouble. Where in the Sudan, it was just across the Red Sea from Saudi Arabia, and we were very worried about Somalia. We'd lost a lot of troops in that humanitarian operation that went so sour in 92, 93, 94.
We have a listener waiting to talk with us on line 4 in Indiana on our toll-free line. Go ahead.
Hello. Since we're being practical, and I certainly agree with you about trying to turn an ocean liner around, though it's unfortunate that the people who were small in number that did have inclinations towards the possibilities of the towers were never heard or listen to, I guess. And if you know anything about that, I'd be interested in knowing about the, you know, this sort of the give and take and what overtakes a group leader and says, "No, I'm going to believe this fellow. I'm not going to believe you." And the second thing is, in a real broad sense, is what we're basically doing now in Iraq on either side of the fence, that will hinder us getting people on the ground, will it not, for the CIA to use as operatives, rather than listening on telephones all the time? Thank you.
Your first point is a very valid one. The most outstanding critic of the regime, or rather of the American bureaucrat who tried to get first the Clinton and then George W. Bush's administration wised up to the Osama threat is Richard Clark, who was the, let's call him a counterterrorist czar on the NSC, and he served three or four American presidents with great distinction. But I'm proud to know Mr. Clark, and but in all fairness, he had a terrible reputation among many senior bureaucrats because he was sort of a bulldozer, and he pushed people around when he thought things had to be done. Well, it turned out that he was quite right, but, you know, state bureaucracies are extremely difficult to move, and sweet suasion doesn't always work. And in Clark's case, even tough stuff and muscle and screaming and pestering didn't work either. But Richard Clark, long before he wrote the book that became a bestseller earlier in the year, had been doing his level best to alert all kinds of people. I mean, people in Washington, people in local state governments, people in local governments, about the danger that was coming down the pike. It was simply that nobody was listening. And in all fairness, once again, the reason nobody was listening is because we had, quote-unquote, won the Cold War. And President Clinton won an election saying the economy's stupid. We wanted, after this enormous effort we'd made for half a century, we wanted to worry about ourselves. So that it was very difficult to get people's attention. And that means Americans, just, you know, John Q. and Jane Q. citizen. We're all guilty. It isn't just the government. But remember, I think I call the 90s a holiday from history. We just didn't want to hear about it. We wanted to worry about our own selves, and for very understandable reasons, but that had a cost.
Yeah.
The other thing is that the Pentagon didn't want to do anything. I mean, there, Clark and two other men who worked on terrorism, counterterrorism on the National Security Council, Daniel Benjamin and Stephen Simon, wrote a book in which it's quite clear that they document how every time Clinton wanted to do something about Osama, General Shelton, who is the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, invented many, many reasons not to do a damn thing. Why? Because in this atmosphere of peace, quote-unquote, after the end of the Cold War, the military didn't want to get involved in a war in which they saw no exit strategy from, and that they didn't know if the American people were going to be 100% behind it. And for a long time, probably the Pentagon was right. I mean, who got killed? The diplomats in American embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam, mm-hmm. in East Africa, and American sailors on the USS Cole, and servicemen. I mean, basically, these were government servants. Servants. They've been sent abroad to serve their country. They died in the line of duty. It really took those nearly 2,700 people, just American, plain civilian American citizens, and a lot of foreigners for that matter, in the towers, and the plane crashing into the Pentagon itself to force the uniformed military to do something. But I think for understandable reasons. I've forgotten your second question. I'm sorry.
The second question, well, the listener has hung up, but the second question was about the war in Iraq.
Oh, yes. I think, look, I'm not going to hide what little light I have under a bushel. It's quite obvious to me that the war in Iraq was a terrible mistake. Anybody who knew anything about Iraqi history would have should have known better, and this has given undreamed of a chance for Osama and other jihadi Islamists to jump on the bandwagon to what is, and this is what's important, basically a nationalist reaction to a foreign military occupation. And but this is, you know, Osama, in his wildest dreams, couldn't have dreamed that up. It was just fortuitous, and bad for us, good for him.
Yeah. I've got another listener I'm going to get to in just a half a second here. I'm going to ask him to hold on just for a moment, he or she, and I want to ask you a follow-up here about Iraq. We're looking down the line here to a point where we hope to see elections in Iraq, and there are hopes for democracy. What's your observation on that?
Yeah, I've already said I'm an old man, and I'm probably a cynic. I wasn't a war correspondent for 45 years to be a sunny optimist, but you know, we Americans think that elections cure all problems. Well, they don't, and I don't think they're going to. We don't know how well the elections will come out. We don't, at this point, even know if they're going to be held throughout the country. And even if they are a roaring success, I don't think it's going to mean very much. I mean, as long as the United States government does not say we want to get out, and we seek no permanent military bases in Iraq, the resistance is going to go on. And as far as I can ascertain, the Bush administration has said neither of those things. I mean, we have to show the world, but especially the Iraqi people, that we are not going to use Iraq, quote-unquote, as a military base to dominate the Middle East. As long as we seek that advantage, and we have military bases all over the world, as long as we want military bases in Iraq, keep them, we're going to be in trouble.
Let's talk with that listener now in Urbana, line one. Go ahead.
Yeah, I also believe the bases in Afghanistan are going to be a continuing source of problems, too, because they're, and in both cases, they're arrayed, I understand, along the route of planned or existing pipelines or oil fields. But anyway, I wanted to ask you a question about interview I read in the Daily Telegraph that came out a month after September 11th, and it was the entire interview with Osama bin Laden in Al Jazeera, which kind of pointed to two possibilities of misinformation coming from our government and press, and wanted to know if you knew anything about it, and I'll hang up after I ask. But one part in the interview, he's asked about his health, and he says he's blessed with great health, and one of his favorite things is to ride 40 miles nonstop on a horse, for example. And in another part of the interview, despite the fact that there's been a lot said saying that Osama didn't consider Palestine any big issue, and he kind of picked it up later, this interview way back in 1998, he makes a point of mentioning Palestine, and that he says, in fact, to quote part of it, "The situation is dangerous, and if we do not move now, when the ancient holy site of 1,200 million Muslims has been usurped, then when should people stir?" So if you could address those two questions,
sure.
And I'll hang up. Thanks.
Good. The health question. You know, I spent a lot of time trying to get to the bottom of that question, as you might imagine. And the reason why I've spent so much time is because I have a very good friend who's a British diplomat, known for 40 years, and he was security, well-placed in the security field with the British government. And when I started working on this book at the beginning of 99, I called him up and I said, what do you know about Osama's health? And he said, I can't really talk to you, But I can tell you, we don't think he's going to be around for very long. And I saw him again this summer, the same fellow, and I said, what did you mean? He said, well, we were convinced that his kidney, he had a serious kidney problem, that he would be dead within years. Similarly, I was told by somebody in Washington this summer that President Clinton had been told just before he left the White House in January 2001 that Osama was already dead. So, I mean, yes, there was a lot of disinformation out there, most, and I believe most of it of our own making. And he, it is true that he loves riding horses. I mean, many people, many Saudis do, and Arab stallions are wonderful horses, and he's well known for his ability as a rider. The other thing that's amusing is that after 9/11, the Pakistanis grabbed and the CIA and the FBI questioned a Pakistani doctor who had seen Osama quite recently then, and the doctor was held for a month and questioned backwards and forwards, and he said, you know, the reason I went to see Osama is he got thrown by a horse, but aside from that, he had a back problem. Aside from that, he was in perfect tick. So, you know, I just don't know what the, what to say to you, except that I discovered that we in the United States, and matter of fact, in Illinois, make portable dialysis machines and that weigh about, I think, 20 pounds or maybe 20 kilos, but I think it's 20 pounds. But then somebody said to me, well, if you're out there in the wild and woolly part of Pakistan or Afghanistan, you'd also need another machine to purify the water, and you'd probably need a generator to run both of those machines. So this is not something you just carry on your back, or even you'd have to have a couple of mules or a pickup truck, and that would make you more make it easier to follow you, to pick you out. But I just don't know the truth. It's certainly many people I respect are convinced that he does have a kidney problem and that he does require dialysis. But on the other hand, he sure is living, as we discovered 4 days before the election. I've forgotten the second question now.
Maybe you'd like to comment on Afghanistan. The caller mentioned the situation in Afghanistan with Allied troops still there, U.S. and
well, oh, yes. I think, you know, I think in the Bush administration's rush to get rid of Saddam, we now know that $700 million that had been earmarked for the military campaign in Afghanistan and its aftermath were diverted. You know, twice in our lifetimes, the United States has walked away from Afghanistan. We walked away after the Russians pulled out in 1989, and we pulled once again. We didn't put a lot of troops on the ground after the military campaign that got rid of the Taliban, so that we were asking for the trouble that has developed there, and we now have more troops in Afghanistan than we had in 2001 when we won that famous victory. So I think, you know, we also haven't found the perfect political solution. We remember in 2001, in order to get rid of the Taliban, we relied very much on the Taliban's enemies, the so-called Northern Alliance, made up basically of Tajik and other non-Pashtun tribesmen. The Taliban were basically made up Pashtuns who perhaps account for 40% of the population, but they were our Air Force and their men on the ground were enough to get the better of the Taliban. But we didn't, once that was over, we didn't say, okay, fellows of the Northern Alliance, we need some kind of central government. We need a stronger government in order to solidify the gains of once the Taliban were no longer, we thought were no longer a military threat. The result was we didn't do that. We backed the warlords, and we now are doing, we're paying the price. That said, Afghan history, by and large, is a history of very loosely organized, loosely ruled country with weak central government. So that, once again, perhaps President Bush would have been better advised to not to go to pull the American troop level way down, but to keep it up, because he certainly, this past year, has had to pour more troops into Afghanistan because there are going to be nationwide elections, and had we not done so, those elections would not have been able to take place.
Yeah, there we have to leave it. We've used the time. Jonathan Randall, thank you for talking with us this afternoon. Jonathan Randall is the author of Osama, The Making of a Terrorist. Jonathan Randall, a longtime foreign correspondent, began his career in the 50s in Paris working for United Press. He spent many years working for the Washington Post as a foreign correspondent. Osama, The Making of a Terrorist, published by Knopf.
And that interview came from the Afternoon Magazine archives. It was originally aired November 10th of last year. It's 8 minutes before 2 o'clock, and settlement prices should be in. We're going to have a tag team this afternoon, Dave Dickey, in just a moment. But first, here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks very much, Jason. This afternoon, we'll take a look at the numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade, as we always do, in the wheat pit for the day. After a pretty good rally yesterday across the grains floor and in the oilseed, remember, beans were up a dime. Futures didn't manage to pull that off today. The beans did finish a half cent lower at 535 and a quarter. Some talk this morning, I know, with Dave Dickey when he was talking before the pre-openings that it was going to take a close above, what, 34 or 36, I think. They were thinking, I'll have to take a look at that number here again momentarily, to push these beans on higher. Later in the week, we'll talk again this afternoon with John Hester of L&M Commodities a little bit about that. Let's take a look now at what happened at the Chicago Board of Trade for the afternoon in the wheat pit. The March contract today had a high of 301 and a quarter, their low at 298, and the settlement price at 299 and a quarter, down 2.5 cents. May futures, 309, the high, the low at 305 and three quarters, settled at 306 and three quarters, up 2.5. And the July futures are 315 and three quarters high, 312 and three quarters the low. July soft red winter wheat, your harvest month, finished 3 cents lower at 313 and a half at the Board of Trade. In September's contract, a 318 low, a low high at 321, and a settlement price closer to the low, just a quarter cent above it at $3.19 a bushel, down 3.5 cents. In December wheat, 330 and three quarters the high, the low at 327, settlement price at 327 and a half. They were down 3.25 for the day. March futures, $2 and a quarter the high, low at $1.98 and three quarters, and settlement price at $2 even, down a half cent. May futures, 208 and a quarter the high, the low at 206 and a half, settled 207 and a half, down one for the day. July, 215 and a quarter the high, the low at 213 and a quarter, settled 214 and a half, off three quarters of a cent. And September corn futures, 222 the high, the low at 220 and three quarters, settlement price at 221 and three quarters, they were off a half of the day. December futures, 231 and a half the high, the low at 230 and a quarter, settled 231, down a half. And the March corn, 238 and a half the high, the low at 237 and a half, a settlement price at 238, they were down three quarters for the day. March oats, a 161 and a half high, low at 159, settlement price at 159 and a quarter, down 2 and a quarter. And the May oat futures, 157 and a half the high, the low at $1.55, settled $1.55 and a quarter, and they were down 2 and a quarter for the day. Soy complex now, nearby March soybeans, off a half cent today, 535 and a quarter, the settlement price with a high of 538, a low at 532 and a half. May soybeans, 538 and a half the high, the low at 532 and three quarters, settled at 535 and a half, down three quarters. And the July contract, 540 the high, the low at 535, settlement price at 538, and they were off a quarter of a cent. August futures in the bean pit, 541 and a half the high, the low at 537 and a quarter, settled at $5.39, and they were down a penny and a quarter. September futures were unchanged today. Had a high of 543, a low at 539 and a half. Settlement price right there at 539 and a half on the low. Once again, that September contract unchanged. And the new crop November beans at 549 and three quarters high, low at 545. Settled 547 and three quarters. They were up a quarter of a cent. January soybeans, 553 the high, the low at 551. A settlement price at 551 and a quarter. Down a penny and three quarters. Lots of things happening in the bean pit to talk about today. Of course, there's some discussion that there are some dry weather here in Brazil. We'll hear more about that later this afternoon when we get another report from the National Association of Farm Broadcasters. And Michelle Rook is in Brazil at this moment. In fact, I had a phone call this morning from Eric Rund. He and Dean Malvik, who's a plant pathologist from the University of Illinois, are in Brazil studying rust. We'll hear more about that tomorrow during the Closing Market Report. Be sure to tune in for that. We talked to them a little bit about whether they're growing determinate or non-determinate beans and what the dry conditions might mean to that over time. That's tomorrow. This afternoon, we'll get an update on how much production Michelle Rook thinks that is going to come across as they talk to some of the folks from FAS, the Foreign Ag Service out of USDA there. March bean meal, 164 the high. Low at 160.80, a settlement price at 163.10. They were up 190. And the May bean meal at the Board of Trade for the day, 163.20. The high, the low at 160.30. Settled at 162.80, up 210. March bean oil now, 19.89. The high, the low at 19.55. Settlement price 19.62. They were down 35 cents. And the May oil, 20.08. The high, the low at 19.67. A settlement price at 19.73. And they were off 44 cents. An awful lot going on at the Mercantile Exchange and the Board of Trade. And if you want to find out more, Dave Dickey, and you're in the area of Charleston, you'll be there tomorrow. What, at 7 o'clock? Where might you be?
I will be at the Coles County Farm Bureau offices in Charleston tomorrow evening at 7 for another one of our free AM 580 Agricultural Outlook panels, Todd.
What's happening to the Mercantile Exchange today?
Well, mixed results in the settlements in the cattle complex, but the lean hogs up today after a number of days that had showed a lot of red on the screens. We'll probably want to talk about that with John Hester this afternoon as well. Let's get to the particulars. March cattle's feeder cattle, a high price on the day of 130, a low of 99.85, settling 125, up 12.5 on the day. April, a high price of 99.35, a low of 98.85, settling 99.27.5, down 7.5. And May feeder cattle, a high of 98.55, a low of 97.60, settling 98.52.5, up 52.5 on the day. February live cattle, a high of 90.50, a low of 89.75, settling 90.20, down 20. The March contract, a high of 91.50, a low of 90.80, settling on that low of 90.80, down 20. The April live cattle contract, a high on the day of 87.15, a low of 86.70, settling 87.02.5, up 7.5 on the day. April lean hogs, a high of 73.07.5, a low of 71.85, settling 73 even, up 42.5. May, a high of 74.50, a low of 73.32.5, settling 74.50, settling on the high, up 52.5 on the day. June lean hogs, a high of 77.40, a low of 76.10, settling 77.35, up 27.5. And July, a high of 74.35, a low of 73.10, settling 74.12.5, up 37.5. And the February pork belly contract, a high on the day of